Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
And now, breathe out everyone, okay? And we're going to go into the chill zone. Brendan Kelly, Professor of Psychiatry in Trinity College Dublin. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Brendan.
So Brendan, it's a bank holiday weekend. Feels like summer is here too. So we're going to talk about switching off. And I feel you're not just an expert in psychiatry, you're one very chill individual as well. So it feels like it's been an intense winter, I think, like this chaotic world and all this uncertainty and everything else and the kind of stuff we were talking about in the first hour there. Summer does kind of feel like it's encouraging us to kind of ease back a bit and like simplify, if you will. Is there brain science to that?
Yes, there's a lot of science to that. And, you know, we are built for various rhythms, day and night, and also the seasons of the year. So our bodies, physically and mentally, have adjusted to that and embraced that. And it's good if we go with it. You know, you can't really fight it. So as summer comes and we begin to feel spring, that is to say, warmer temperatures, more sunshine, more outdoor times, our bodies change. A lot of things start to happen. So, for example, our production of melatonin decreases. Now, melatonin is the hormone in your body that sends you to sleep. So we produce a little bit less of that, and we tend to be more active. We tend to wake up with the sun as well, more in the summer than we would in the winter.
So there is actually a slight hibernation effect in the winter, where we kind of hunker down and turn in on ourselves slightly. Well, yeah,
absolutely. There is an echo of the hibernation that other creatures do, but we don't do as much. And this will really resonate with some people who feel that they do hibernate. Also with spring, other things change. Our serotonin levels tend to go up that little bit. Now, serotonin has a lot of different functions in the body, but perhaps most famously, it's associated with positivity and with good mood. So summer does genuinely bring this increase in our mood, this improvement in our mood, and also changes in our focus and our concentration, which tend to be better as vitamin D production also ramps up with the sun. And that really helps with mental function. I know some people take vitamin D supplements during the winter, but really nothing can compare with the power of the sun boosting the vitamin D and boosting the mental agility along with the serotonin.
Okay, so it is actually happening. You're not actually a fan of summer though, are you?
Well, I'm not the biggest fan of summer. You know, you won't necessarily find me wearing flip-flops and shorts on day one of the springtime out the back flipping burgers on a barbecue. But I do enjoy the summer in a different way. I'm not particularly a beach person or a water sports person, but those things are very good. Water sports particularly tend to be very mentally healthy because they force you to come out of your head, out of the cognitive, out of the thinking, out of the overthinking, and more into the physical body. Because for a great part of the year and our lives, we treat our physical body as a machine for carrying around our brains, and we fail to dip into the nourishment that it can give us. And something like a water sport really forces you out of your head and into your body, so it can be very helpful to do those things, obviously particularly in the summertime.
Okay, so yeah, explain that a bit more, because it does feel like, which I presume they do, it feels like our brains are grinding away all the time, like solving imaginary problems and thinking about work and worrying about ourselves, the people around us, the state of the world. Is it all going in our heads all the time, yeah?
Yeah, to a degree it is. I mean, our brains have 86 billion nerve cells in them, and they're all active all the time, and they're all each one is connected to around 10,000 neighbouring nerve cells in the brain. So that is trillions of connections firing hundreds of chemicals back and forth. To be honest, our brains are more complicated than we can cope with. And, you know, there's a very famous say, and we don't understand it fully. The physicist Emerson Pugh, he said, if our brains were so simple that we could understand them, we would be so simple that we couldn't, because our brains are simply too complicated. And anything that helps us to step away from that hyper-cognitive life, that too much thinking about thinking, living is good.
And is it all, and is most of it junk, yeah? Is most of it pointless junk?
An enormous amount of it is pointless junk. Certainly in the longer term, it's pointless junk, even if it feels very acute to us in the moment.
Yeah.
So if we can either dial it down a little or step away from it, we will be doing ourselves a huge favour. And we do have this enormous resource, which is the rest of our body, which is connected with our brains through our necks. It's like we forget sometimes we have necks.
Okay, okay.
And therefore, everything we do with our physical body will affect our brains as well, because we are embodied creatures. We're not just these sort of disembodied brains or disembodied thinking machines floating through the world.
Okay, so it's a two-way street, in fact. We tend to think that our brain is telling our body what to do, but the body can kind of send signals up to the brain about what to do as well.
It is all a single organism. You know, yes, it's a two-way street, but it's very much the same thing. And one of the hormones that other hormones that changes in the summer is our cortisol. And this is our so-called stress hormone. It's the one that surges in a flight or fight situation. But that changes in the summer, and the rhythm of that becomes crisper. So what happens is, when we wake up in the summer, we wake up more alert. We have more cortisol kicking us off in the day in the summer than we have kicking us off in the day in the winter. And that means that when we wake in the summer, we're ready to do more physical things. Our bodies are ready to get.
So that's cortisol doing a good thing, because we tend to associate it these days with being a bad thing. Because I think a lot of people feel they're stuck in a constant kind of cortisol kind of.
Yeah. So a lot of us are stuck in what we'd call a constant hypercortisolemic state. In other words, our cortisol is chronically high. We live on edge. We are hypervigilant. Mm. It's like we're waiting for something terrible to happen all of the time, and we're all keyed up. And this is very unhealthy. This is negative for every single organ in the body: the brain, the heart, the lungs, the skin, the muscles, living in this hypercortisolemic state that so many of us live in now. So what the summer does is it makes the daily cortisol cycle a little crisper, and it also should make us more aware of it. So we can also use cortisol for good by reducing our, if you like, baseline cortisol, and only letting it surge when we absolutely need to. And low stress situations are good for that. And the other hormone that is affected by low stress situations is something called oxytocin. So this will be my last hormone of the day, I think. And oxytocin is known commonly as the love hormone. Now, that is partly science-based and partly vibes-based, if I'm honest.
Okay, yeah. But mothers not flooded with oxytocin when they hold their baby for the first time?
Exactly. And it's to do with bonding. It's to do with really connecting emotionally with other people. And in low-stress situations, like, say, being on holiday, being away from the cut and thrust of everyday life, we have more oxytocin available to us. So, and that is part of the reason, perhaps, why holidays can be a time of connection, a time of romance, and a time of other kinds of bonding.
We're
excitement.
More open to everything. Mm. So on the busy brain, you say that there are two modes. There's a kind of a switch off mode as well. Tell me about default mode.
Yeah, so our brains never switch off fully. Our brains have to keep doing stuff, reminding us to breathe, reminding us to stay alive and things like this. So they don't switch off to nothing. But what we can do is we can try to switch off some of the task-based brain activity and just get it down to its baseline default level, because it won't ever switch off completely. So it's all about trying to get back down to that level and reduce these extra tasks that we worry about. Our brains are constantly active. That will always be the case, even while we're asleep. But if we turn off some of the more conscious, goal-directed tasks, we'll be left with our default mode for the brain. And that's what we're aiming for on holidays.
Okay. So how we'll come to holidays, maybe. How would someone access that at the end of the day? You finish work, you come home, or you go into the other room if you're working from home, and you're keyed up and the brain's still busy. How do you wind down the alert brain?
Well, you need a ritual at the working day for the end of work. So if you are working at home, it makes enormous sense to go out, walk around the block and arrive back home again. So you've walked home from work, even if you haven't actually gotten anywhere. And that has the benefit as well of being a physical activity. It gets you out of the thinking, planning mode, gets you away from the to-do list, and it gets you away from this idea that life is a series of tasks or a self-improvement project. So you need a little bit of physical activity at the end of the day to get out of the doing mode and into the being mode. The other thing that is very helpful is to introduce a physical feeling. One of the most powerful ways of doing this is tuning into the feeling of, for example, your feet on the floor.
Yeah.
You can enhance that if you want to take off your shoes or be barefoot. And you enhance it if you stand outside barefoot as well. And you just tune into that feeling of the physical feeling of the soles of your feet on the floor, on the ground, rather than thinking about it. And that physical sensation can help you let go of the stresses of the day as well.
Interesting, right? I'd say she won't mind me saying this, but my mother, who is by no means some kind of a new age guru or anything, one of her old Joanies, I told her she had to get a grounding mat, that they were great. She has got a grounding mat. Mm-hmm. Apparently you plug it in, but it's not electrified, but you plug it in to earth it or something.
Yeah.
And you put your bare feet on it and when you're sitting down, and she thinks it's working. As I say to her, if you think it's working, it's working. So grounding does
Absolutely does work. You're grounding yourself in the earth and giving yourself a sense of solidity, or rather tuning into the sense of solidity, which is always within us anyway, because we contain the potential for great calmness and great clarity if we simply allow things to settle. And the thing we struggle most with allowing to settle is our brains.
And you can't unthink the thinking. It has to be about diverting to the physical is the only answer. Yeah.
It is the only answer. If there are too many thoughts or lots of negative thoughts, it is almost impossible to counteract them with positive thoughts. You need to counteract thoughts with behaviours, physical sensations and feelings, and really tune into them. And if you do this, it's not as hard as it sounds. It is, in fact, a releasing of tension, and it can become very natural.
And it will divert the attention away from the brain.
From the brain, away from the thinking, away from the to-do list, away from everything you think you should be doing, and into the physical sensations of the present moment.
Okay. Now, the to-do list is an interesting one. I think that one of the kind of traps of modern life, if you will, is that we think, I'll relax when I've everything done, right? Mm. But everything is never done.
Mm-hmm.
So you never relax. The trick is, how do you relax if there's still stuff to be that you know you should do? And like if it's in the area looking at you and stuff, you know?
Yeah. So, look, it can be very hard. First, the to-do list is in our heads. No one else knows our to-do list, really, the things we feel we should be doing. So it's all about managing our thoughts. If the tasks are around you, and we're talking here about a house that needs to be cleaned, laundry that needs to be done, a window that needs fixing, in that case, stepping away from it is very helpful. Also, you don't need to decide not to do the things on your list. Many of them, you can just decide to delay them by an hour or by a day or whatever, and rethink at that point, and you will find a lot of them didn't need doing, certainly didn't need doing as quickly as you thought. The to-do list will never be finished. Another approach to this...
So I'll do it later.
I'll do it later, or I'll think about it later.
Yeah.
In other words, I'll revisit this in an hour, and you might find the need has passed, or if you're very lucky, someone else will have done it.
Is a lot of this just getting past or the urges in the moment? Will a lot of them pass if you just get past them, yeah?
Virtually all of the urges to act in the moment will pass. If we simply let the moment pass, they will go with them. Some tasks need to be done, and they can be scheduled, or they can be done now if they're absolutely necessary, but many can be deferred and will no longer be necessary. This is hard to do because we live in a world that screams at us that there is a to-do list. There are tasks to be accomplished, and we often measure our so-called worth, our so-called self-esteem, based on how much we have done. And these are really quite dangerous ideas. A much better concept is the notion of self-acceptance or self-compassion, that you, I, are of value, are of worth simply by being, not on the basis of any list of accomplishments, which will never be long enough.
Have you got there?
Self-acceptance.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, in my case, I've been forced into fairly radical self-acceptance because of the many, many imperfections that have become apparent to me over the years. So I've had no choice except to embrace a lot of imperfection. But I think it's a work in progress always.
Yeah.
Accepting yourself as you are, as opposed to yourself as a list of accomplishments. You know, you are more than your CV. You are more than your to-do list. You are more than your done list as well. That each person has intrinsic worth, which is unchangeable and inviolable. And I worry a great deal about, for example, the concept of self-esteem, the way it is sometimes used, the idea that there is a notion or a quantity about how much you should esteem yourself.
Yeah.
Whereas in fact, self-acceptance is a much, much better path to go down, and self compassion, this idea that there will be imperfection and like everything, everything we do will be imperfect, but nevertheless we accept ourselves for who we are.
Okay. On a slightly different related note then, I think particularly, probably since the start of the pandemic, right, I think people can find the news cycle a bit overwhelming at times, kind of non-stop, a lot of it bad. They get drawn into this roller coaster of outrage and atrocity and all that kind of thing. Any advice on that? Like, I mean, I think some people feel guilty about switching off as well, as if like I should care about everything.
Yes, and we should care about the world. We should care about the state of the planet, the political state of the world. But these are what we might call the universal. These are very big happenings, big things, and we often treat them emotionally as if we should be solving them fully ourselves. So in relation to managing that, I don't think switching off from the news or current affairs is a good idea, because that just leads to infinite worries that are not based on reality. But we need a twin track in our head.
Okay.
We need to look at what's happening in the world, be aware of the problems, be aware of potential solutions, but not be overwhelmed by that, because we as individuals will not solve it. That's one track. We need to be aware of that, the universal. But there is also the personal. There is what we need to do in our own lives, and there is a link. We should live our lives in such a way not to make global problems worse, and ideally try and fix them as best we can. But too often, and particularly during the pandemic, we walked around carrying the burdens of the entire world on our shoulders. And I guess the availability of so much information and data didn't help.
Yeah.
You had people checking.
And I think it got us in a habit, didn't it? Even when the pandemic ended, we kind of took that kind of vibe and applied it to everything that was going on then a bit.
Yeah, that raw immediacy of the pandemic, the way that the universal could suddenly become so personal. If you got COVID or someone in your family got COVID, you didn't just have an illness, you had a global pandemic. That connection between the universal and the personal hasn't faded entirely. And I do think we feel global affairs more acutely and personally than we did before. And that is not helpful. That is too much for us to walk around with emotionally and cognitively each day.
So try and watch the rapids flowing past, if you will, but don't be kind of in the river, like tossing around in the rapids is the idea. Yeah?
Absolutely. We do need to watch the rapids, though, because it is our world and we need to take care of it and each other. But, you know, we should not feel personal responsibility for the universal. And I know logically, cognitively, we don't. But emotionally, we often do. And we feel bad on behalf of the world when, in fact, we probably should be getting on with our days as best as possible.
OK, good. A lot of people's idea of switching off in the evening is to turn on some often these days quite undemanding television. Is that okay, Ilan?
Oh, I've no problem with undemanding television. I have a habit, and I feel ready to speak publicly about this now, of watching romantic films on streaming services, formulaic romances, things like, I don't know, Romance at the Villa or things like this. And I have to say, I find that it's very helpful. It's formulaic, it's undemanding. It doesn't particularly exercise the imagination or the cognition, but that's perfectly good. I mean, our excessively complicated brains, Brendan, we spend a lot of time trying to turn them off. And some people try to turn it off using alcohol and drugs and things like this, which is a very unhelpful mechanism for, you know, calming down the waves of cognition, the too much thinking. Yeah. So we do need other ways. As I say, using the physical body through physical exercise or activity is one really good way. But let's face it.
But is a bit of dumb TV, so is enough to keep the conscious mind occupied, that you're absorbed enough in it that you're not thinking about other things. Is that the idea?
A bit of dumb TV is very helpful. Not too much of it, but a bit of it is certainly a good way to switch off.
What about people who spend their few hours before bed scrolling through their phones?
Scrolling through social media or the phones is an entirely different pastime, because our comparing brains compare our lives with what we see on social media, even if such comparisons are completely ridiculous. So for For example, if one is scrolling through, say, I was looking at something online, and let's say, I don't even know who, let's say a picture of Katy Perry came up, for example, then my brain would, ridiculous as it sounds, compare myself to Katy Perry.
You'd win at the moment, but anyway, we'd be talking about it in a while.
Let's be honest, I'm a sort of a balding middle-aged man in Ireland comparing myself to a global pop sensation who went to space. And what my brain would do is it would do the comparison. It would immediately dismiss the comparison as utterly ridiculous, but the emotional hit would have already happened. And so what happens with the scrolling is we do end up with negative emotions that are not justified by facts. So that is quite different to, say, reading a book, watching some dumb TV, or maybe taking a short walk in the evening, which is a much better way to
try and
switch off.
That's interesting. So even if we know consciously that that's ridiculous,
yeah,
our subconscious takes the emotional hit anyway, yeah?
It does. The cortisol has changed already. And, you know, we can calm that down, but the hit has happened. So it is useful to sort of watch how we spend our time. And even when we dismiss something logically, you know, our bodies have responded physically already. The hormones have shifted, change has happened, and we've taken an emotional hit.
Okay, so you mentioned holidays earlier, and the school holidays will be with us soon enough. And look, they call them holidays, like, but for a lot of parents, they think of stress, like, and trying to juggle kids, camps, this, that, and the other, and everything. Any advice for people on how to kind of keep it more chill in the school holidays?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about balance, and balance, which is very hard to achieve. So you want to plan certain things, but not over plan. And this can be very difficult with children who might be attending multiple summer activities, and parents who are still working for part or all of the summer with complex dropping and picking arrangements. So a certain amount of planning is clearly helpful, but over planning can prove more of a burden than a benefit, particularly on family holidays, or, you know, going away on holiday.
Is it okay for kids to be doing nothing sometimes, like for maybe quite some time?
Yeah.
They seem happy enough.
They're very happy doing nothing because they do find things to do. And the lack of purposeful activity is an important part of being human. So for us adults, for example, things like daydreaming and drifting around the place are very important for our memories and for our thinking skills at other times. And similarly for children, time spent hanging around and finding things to do at home is helpful for their cognitive and emotional development.
And we're not delinquent parents if we're not paying them attention all the time.
No, not at all. I mean, what we can most best offer to children is a steady, supportive environment. In other words, we need to show them that we're there if needed. That means being there a lot of the time, to be honest, but it also means being absent, so they learn what's called secure attachment, so that they can still feel the benefits of the attachment even when you're not in their line of vision.
Are a lot of us modelling very busy, stressy lives to our kids?
Yes, we model, you know, I mean, one of the things about children, and one of the scary moments, is when you realize that they're imitating your behavior and turning out like you. And a lot of parents find that quite shocking. So yes, if we say overuse our phones, for example, we'll find children doing the same. If we cram our times with structured activities, they will tend to do the same. But if children see us being able to switch off a little bit, relax a little bit, and let things flow a little more rather than driving everything, they too will learn that skill, which will stand to them in life. Now, summer is a good time for doing this. But as you say, it can also be a stressful time when children tend to need some structured activities as well.
Yeah, okay. Do you have a line in your notes, lower your expectations radically is the key to happiness?
Yes. Setting low expectations and constantly exceeding them is a good way to go. Yeah. This works in many, many different settings. You know, and our expectations should be more vague. The expectation of a holiday should be to enjoy it and have some restful, peaceful time rather than, you know, visit 13 different monuments.
You don't have to be living your best life constantly, like.
No, yeah. We need to have that space where we can tune into the beautiful sunset, where we can tune into the, you know, the sight of the beach and the sky and the rocks and the mountains, or walking for people who go hiking. We need to create spaces like that away from away from our troubles. A friend of mine, he went on a meditation retreat. I remember he paid a lot of money. He said this was a really expensive meditation retreat. And he said it was so good, he said, and so expensive, they took away his phone. And I remember laughing at that, thinking that he took that. I felt you could have just stepped away from the phone yourself to begin with and kept the money. But we pay people to do things that we could do ourselves if we were sufficiently organized and if we prioritized our well-being a little bit more.
Do you think put away the phone and the laptop and everything on holidays? Because I can find it better I can relax more 99% of the time if I check in 1% of the time.
Yeah. Look, it's not realistic to say put away the phone and the laptop 100%. That's just not the nature of modern life. And, we're setting ourselves up to fail often if we say that. So certainly when I'm away, I too find it restful if I check into the emails once a day, delete a load of rubbish, anything that is a work-related task, put it in a folder to be done when I go home, and then I'm done. 20, 30 minutes of that each day, and I'm settled for the rest of the day. And I don't think that's a bad thing if we manage it okay and don't let it take over all of our time. We do also need time away from the phone, away from the laptop, to feel the warmth of the sun on our faces, the sand between our toes, look at the golden sunsets and, drink things from little coconut shells with umbrellas in them. We need that for sure. But for some people, a quick check-in will also provide reassurance and support for that to happen.
In terms of going away, if we change our location, does it automatically help us switch off? I often find like just doing the geographical, even if it's to somewhere nearby, but it's somewhere different, that you kind of do, you're getting out of your day-to-day grind. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It changes everything, and it changes it in a very sensory way. So one of the most amazing experiences for me is when I'm lucky enough to go on long distance travel and say stepping off an airplane in India or in Japan or somewhere like that. Suddenly you're struck by a different sound, different sights. It smells different. It feels different. And that alone, it taps into your senses. It brings us back into our physical bodies, and you think, whoa, what's this? Where have I landed? It's like a different planet. And that is a glorious way of pressing the reset button. Now, we can do it without going to such exotic locations. There are many, many places in Ireland if we change our physical setting. And this is known as proxemics. We're affected by what's proximal to us, by what's around us.
Right.
We do what's there. This has been researched a lot, particularly in relation to marriage, because we form relationships.
So we're not all individuals with free will making all these choices. Whatever's in front of us defines
what we do and who we are. To put it another way, like, you're not going to form a relationship and marry someone who isn't there. So like, it's the people you surround yourself with and the places you go that shape who we are. Our connection with other people and our environment is far more intimate than we think. To the degree with other people that the boundary between us and other people is very blurry. We interact so carefully with others that we are shaped by the minds and the feelings of all the people around us.
Go on, explain that a little bit more. We're coming to the end, but that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are brain cells in our brains, Brendan, called mirror neurons, and their entire purpose is, my mirror neurons are telling me to do exactly what you do now in terms of facial expression and gesture. That is what they're telling me. A bunch of other brain cells are telling me to do other stuff, but our connection with other people in our proximity is almost biological continuity. And because of this, we are intensely and intimately shaped by who we surround ourselves with, where we go, and what we put in our environment. We are not these freestanding, independent creatures we imagine ourselves to
be. So that whole thing about, like, if you look at your kids' three best friends or five best friends or whatever, and that's who your kid is. There's more truth to that than we think.
There's a lot of truth to that. And, look at your own surroundings as well, the people you choose to surround yourself with. And you don't have full choice in that either. And that too is shaped by circumstance. So I guess the idea about taking holidays, tuning out, powering down a little, it's about managing ourselves. But that means managing who we're with, where we are and what we do. We are not...
Not everyone has that choice either, of course.
No. I mean, we all have limits, and some people more limits than others. The key is to identify what we can change and to lower our expectations very often and cultivate a degree of self-acceptance.
Okay. Well, listen, I'm mirroring you now. I feel totally chill after that. I could go and lie down. Professor Brendan Kelly, excellent. Thank you very much.